Let's turn to Daniel chapter 3. And in this session, I intend to take two chapters. We did that in our previous tape set, which was made years ago. And it's a very realistic thing to anticipate. Usually, I can't cover two chapters in a single session. It took two sessions to cover chapter 2. But that was a very long chapter and full of prophecy that needed interpretation, prophetic dream, requiring some consideration of different interpretive possibilities. But in Daniel chapters 3 and 4, we have largely narrative stories. The first of them is told about Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel presumably wrote the chapter and tells us this story about Nebuchadnezzar and his confrontation with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then chapter 4 is actually written by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's the last chapter in which he appears in the book of Daniel. And we find that virtually every time Nebuchadnezzar appears in the story, whether it's chapter 2, chapter 3, or chapter 4, he ends up praising the God of Israel. And it makes you wonder whether, you know, this man, maybe we'll see him in heaven. He was a pagan king. He worshipped other gods, but again and again he acknowledged Jehovah, the God of the Jews. He didn't actually, I don't think, use the term Jehovah when he's speaking of him, but he did speak of the Most High God and the God of Daniel and the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so it's hard to know, you know, whether these were expressions of true conversion or whether they were simply momentary exclamations of being impressed by what God had demonstrated himself capable of doing each time Nebuchadnezzar had an opportunity to see it. Daniel himself does not figure at all in the story in chapter 3. He doesn't appear. And that's interesting because in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar sets up an image and requires all of his officials to bow down and worship the image. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel's three friends, do not bow down and therefore they have to face the king's wrath. But we don't read of Daniel in the story at all. We don't find him bowing down or refusing to bow down. He's just not in the picture. This it may be, however, that, as we shall see, that since Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were informed upon, and Nebuchadnezzar might not have known about their disobedience had not somebody informed on them, it's possible that Daniel also disobeyed the king's order, but nobody informed on him for whatever reason. Maybe he went unnoticed, and that he got away with it, whereas Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were caught. It's also possible that Daniel, at this particular time, was somewhere out of the area on some official business. He was a high-ranking official in the Babylonian government, and he may have been in some other city at the time that this story took place, and therefore it never became an issue with him, but it did for his friends. In any case, what I'm going to do is, for the most part, just read the story in chapter 3. Of course, I'll make comments on it, but I'll make some overall comments on the lessons of the story after we've looked at the whole chapter. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. A cubit being 18 inches approximately, this means the statue is about 90 feet tall and only about 9 feet wide. So if it was a human image, which is probable, it was not a very realistic human image. It would be very stylized. It was more like an obelisk, so like a tall tower. 10 times as tall as it was wide. Certainly is not the proportions of a human being, but it could have been in a general human shape. It would be about as tall as the date palms, which were the highest structures in Babylon at the time. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, this was a particular event of dedication. It is not necessary to assume that these officials would have to, on a regular basis, bow down to this image, but on the occasion of its dedication, they had to do so. And as I said, Daniel may have been out of town at this particular time and have escaped a conflict. You'll notice there's quite a number of administrative officials of different ranks mentioned. Most of them are very hard to identify because of the ancient language. This portion, this is in the portion of Daniel that's written in Aramaic, a very ancient language, and not all the words are known to have as far as what their exact meaning is. Some of the translations are brought out of the Greek, the Septuagint translation, but some of the words are thought to be loan words from Greek language. Some may be loan words from Old Persian, and commentators are not sure exactly what the Aramaic words mean in every case. The word satraps, the first mentioned, seems to be the highest ranking of the officials mentioned, and the word literally means protectors. And so a satrap was a protector, and probably refers to the governors of the provinces. And then we have, of course, later some of these words are translated as governors and administrators and counselors. The word counselors apparently in the Aramaic means magistrates or judges, but we have another term that's translated judges later on. So we just and magistrates too. So we have to just live with some uncertainty as to what exactly the range of authority was for each of these officers. What we will find is that they are mentioned. Their total list is mentioned again, and there is a certain amount of redundancy in the way the story is told, and that may be deliberate, but it says in verse 3, so the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Again, these musical instruments, which are listed in great detail, similar to the list of officials, this list of instruments comes up again and again and again, too. Again, there's kind of the account could be compressed if somebody was interested in brevity. That is, if the writer had been more interested than he was in brevity. But he likes to repeat again and again the number of or the different kinds of musical instruments and the officials. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship your gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time, you hear the sound of the horn, flutes, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace was exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he arose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men, loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other god who can deliver like this." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Okay, that's the story. And most of us know the story pretty well, even without having read it this time, just because it's one of those stories, like Daniel in the lion's den, that is often told. I mean, Sunday school children, children raised in Sunday school, or who have Bible storybooks and so forth, or children's Bibles, they always have pictures emphasis on this story, because it's one of the tremendous miracles of deliverance that we have in the Bible. Now, of course, there's always those who try to undermine the historical accuracy of the story, who would say, well, we don't have any record of such an image ever being made in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Archaeologists have never found this huge image. There is certainly no record in the existing Babylonian records of the period of Nebuchadnezzar ever making such a decree to defend the Jews' right to worship their God and to not be maligned by anybody at the pain of death on the part of those who would persecute them. And so we have no verification of the events in this story from secular sources, but that is really irrelevant. The real objection stems from the fact that we have here a miracle of men thrown into a furnace that was so hot that even those who had bound them and threw them in were killed by exposure to the heat, and yet these men found only their bonds to be burned off of them in the fire. Their clothing was untouched. Their hair didn't have the smell of smoke upon it. It wasn't singed. And this simply can't happen. This simply is impossible, apart from a miracle. And, of course, there are many scholars who are indisposed to acknowledging the reality of miracles. And so anything they might say about the lack of historical verification for this is really based not on the fact that there is in fact no historical verification, but their objection really lies deeper with a basic prejudice against supernaturalism and supernatural occurrences. After all, we have but little documentation of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. The last, I think, 11 years or more, no, the last 30 years of his life are not documented in Babylonian records. There are later on in the 4th century B.C. some Greek historians who document some things from the later reign of Nebuchadnezzar, but the contemporary records that come out of Babylon are fairly silent about the last 30 years of his reign. So it's a senseless objection to say, well, we don't have any record of this happening. Well, we don't have any record of anything happening. And this may well be among the things that did happen. We should be cautious about criticizing Daniel for recording things that are not verifiable from secular history, because there have been times, as we have pointed out in our introduction to Daniel, that Daniel's book alone was stood as a witness for hundreds of years to certain facts about the Babylonian kingdom that were not known by other historians. Perhaps most notably the business about Belshazzar being the king at the time of Babylon's fall. Even the historians 400 years or 300 years before Christ, Herodotus and Thucydides and such, had not remembered Belshazzar and his existence. But Daniel had, and it wasn't until the last century, about 1853, that archaeologists discovered there was a Belshazzar and learned of his role, and it harmonizes very well with what Daniel says. So there may be instances, there are in fact instances, where Daniel's witness is the lone witness from history of certain events that actually did happen. And therefore the lack of any verification of this from archaeology or from secular history is no argument at all against its historical veracity. Actually, many things about it are agreeable with the general what is generally known about Babylon, about Nebuchadnezzar's reign. For example, that he would burn people in the fire is documented also from history and also even elsewhere in Scripture. In Jeremiah 29, there's a reference to Nebuchadnezzar having burned people in fire. In Jeremiah 29, in verse 22, it says, "And because of them a curse shall be taken up by all the captivity of Judah who are in Babylon, saying, The Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire." This king of Babylon in Jeremiah was Nebuchadnezzar. So there were men who were roasted in the fire by Nebuchadnezzar, documented in Jeremiah's book, who had, of course, not any interest particularly in verifying Daniel, since he had not read Daniel's book. That the king of Babylon burned people in the fire, therefore, is realistic. And it's not necessarily likely that a writer of a book like Daniel, writing 300 years later, which is what the skeptics think is when Daniel was written, they would 300 or 400 years later, actually. I mean, it was written back in the 6th century B.C. There are many who would place it in the 2nd century B.C. But in the 2nd century B.C., it's not as likely that a writer would know that this was a common practice of Babylonian kings when they executed people, was to burn them. After all, the Persians didn't do that. The Persians replaced the Babylonian Empire, and they threw people to the lions, which is also agreeable with what Daniel tells us in chapter 6. Anyway, as I say, the lack of historical verification from other sources is irrelevant. Daniel is as good a historical source as any other, and the only thing that would make people doubt it is really that they are predisposed against believing in miracles, and this is certainly the story of a miracle. Now, why Nebuchadnezzar did this, built this image, we do not know. Some have suggested that because he had a dream in chapter 2, and Daniel had identified Nebuchadnezzar himself as the head of gold of an image that he saw, that he went ahead and made an image, possibly even an image of himself, though it's not stated to be so, and made the whole thing of gold. Since the gold represented him, he might as well extend his own glory and significance to the whole thing. But all of this is conjecture. There's nothing in chapter 3 that connects the image in identity or in significance with the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream in chapter 2. We simply, that's just a playground for conjecture. What we can say is that he probably set up the image in order to encourage a solidarity of his government. Remember, he had conquered peoples of all nations and all languages and so forth, and these various nations and peoples and cultures had their own religious systems. And religion is one of those things that's deeply ingrained in people, in their culture, and to unite a people under one religion, or to at least cause them to acknowledge the validity of one central deity, is something that has often been done in history to try to consolidate people from different cultures and different religions, get them to submit to a single religious icon. We find that those who are told to bow down in verse 4 are said to be peoples, nations, and languages. And the emphasis is on this international community of persons who are called to worship this one deity. And now, what's interesting is the only persons reported to disobey were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Jews. Now, there may have been some other Jews who did submit to the king and didn't obey. Not all of the Jews who were carried into Babylon were of the faithful remnant. And in Ezekiel, God showed Ezekiel that even the Jews in the captivity in Babylon had idols in their hearts, and some of them might gladly have bowed down to an idol outwardly rather than be thrown in the fiery furnace. In fact, many of them had voluntarily done so without the threat of the fiery furnace back in Jerusalem. That's why they were taken into Babylon. They were quite disposed to worship idols. It may be that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were the only high-ranking Jews who would be called to this assembly, who were really of the faithful remnant at all. And Daniel, again, as I said, may not have been nearby, may not have been around at this time. We don't know. In any case, those of all other religions gladly submitted, because all other religions other than Judaism believed in multitudes of gods anyway. Bowing down to an image didn't violate their religion, even if their religion basically admired some other false god than this image. They could always add another god to their pantheon. It was in the nature of paganism that they acknowledged many gods to be worthy of worship. In fact, many of them even acknowledged the God of the Jews as an additional God with some validity, but they didn't worship him alone. Only Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego simply could not bow to this demand. And so, of course, they were reported on. We're told that certain Chaldeans came in verse 8 and reported on them and said that they were not submitting to the king. Now, the Chaldeans who did this, we're not told what motivated them. It's possible that they were jealous of the authority Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had, because we know at the end of chapter 2, because Daniel and his three friends had been associated with each other in the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and we read at the end of chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar had exalted Daniel, and at Daniel's request, in verse 49, had set also Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. It's possible that these native Babylonians resented these foreigners having positions higher than their own. We see that that is the case in chapter 6, when Daniel was set over all the other satraps and so forth. There apparently was jealousy involved on the part of those who set a trap to ensnare Daniel. And there may have been jealousy involved on the part of these Chaldeans, who were quite happy to find Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not in compliance so that they could get them into trouble and remove some rivals of whom they were very jealous. It's also possible, if such jealousy was not present, that they simply felt that they could earn some promotion in the sight of the king by exposing some traitors. To expose somebody who's not loyal to the king often would give you favor in the sight of the king and possibly even promotion. In the book of Esther, Mordecai exposed some men who were plotting to kill King Ahasuerus, and he was not immediately rewarded for it, but when the king became aware of it and that the man had not been rewarded, he wanted to honor him greatly. It would be perhaps expected by these Chaldeans that if they could discover to the king and expose some disloyal leaders, possibly some traitors, that this discovery and this exposure would possibly propel those informants to a position of higher honor than they already had. Whatever, it may also have just been, you know, that they all hated each other and they were glad to report on anybody who wasn't compliant. Although we're not told what their motives were here, we know from chapter 6 that those who reported on Daniel and had him thrown into the lion's den were motivated by jealousy. Nebuchadnezzar did not condemn Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego on hearsay evidence alone, however. He already had occasion to be impressed with them and to give them special notice, as we saw in chapter 2. And so he might have even suspected that the accusations could be false, and he didn't want to lose several good men from his administration upon a false accusation, so he gave them an opportunity to answer for themselves. And they confirmed that what he had heard was true. In fact, they did it in a rather defiant tone. In fact, when Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them in verse 15, he says, "Now, if you are ready at this time to hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you should be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." You know, their answer almost mimicked his form of statement, because in verse 15 says, "Now, if you are ready, but if you do not..." Well, their answer kind of mimicked that in verse 17 and 18. They said, "If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your God, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Their answer has been interpreted a variety of ways, because the first line, which is translated here, "if that is the case," is a very almost untranslatable phrase in the Aramaic. As you can see, even in the New King James, the last three of those five words are in italics. They're not actually in the original. Just "if that" is how these translate it. There are some who say the most literal translation is, or would be, "if our God exists, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us." But most people don't think that they would say that, since they also go on to say, "but if not," in other words, if he doesn't exist, we still won't worship your God. It seems very unlikely that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's theology would allow them to say, "if our God exists, and if he doesn't, we still won't worship your God," as if they weren't even sure that God existed. Another translation that many scholars have felt might be the correct one is they were saying, if our God is able to, he will deliver us. But if he's not able to, we still won't bow down. Now that is, I think, probably not likely to be their meaning either, although it's not impossible. Although they were loyal to God, they had never heard of a case probably previously of his delivering people through the fire. And they may well have been uncertain whether this is the kind of thing God could do, although I don't think they'd be uncertain of that. But in any case, whether he could deliver them or not, they weren't going to bow. The most common interpretation, I think, that people have given to it, and probably the correct one, is that they're saying, if what you're saying is true, and if God wills it, he can show you that he is such a God as can deliver us from your hands. The very question that Nebuchadnezzar asked at the end of verse 15, "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" They may be saying, "Well, our God is the one who will deliver us from your hands, we hope, if he will. But he might not. But whether he does or not, we will not bow." In any case, whatever the exact meaning of their "if that is the case" phrase is, it's clear that they're saying that their confidence is in God, and it is likely that they're affirming that God, in fact, is able and likely to deliver them, but he doesn't have to. And whether he does or not, even if he does not deliver them, that's not going to change the fact that they will be loyal to him. There are some people who I have met who, because they believe God is able to deliver from hard times or from martyrdom or from tribulation or whatever, they assume that he must. He's able to, so of course he would. And I've actually heard some say, "But if he doesn't, I'm not sure I even want to be a Christian." I've actually met people and talked to people who have made that statement. "Well, if the rapture isn't before the tribulation, if we're going to have to go through it, I don't even know if I want to be a Christian." Well, that's an amazing confession for someone to make. It's certainly the opposite of a Christian attitude, and it certainly indicates they probably aren't Christians who are saying it. If a person's loyalty to God depends on God not giving them hard times, not letting them go through struggles, then they could not be Christians practically anywhere in the world except here in America and a few places else that are under European influence. I mean, such people couldn't be a Christian even right now, with or without a pre-trib rapture. They couldn't be a Christian right now in China or in Cuba or in North Korea or a whole bunch of other places around the world. And because they simply wouldn't want to be a Christian if they have to go through tribulation. And there's certainly no tribulation that a future Antichrist could inflict that is worse than what anti-Christian governments have inflicted historically upon Christians. I mean, what worse can be done to people than to have their skin peeled off and have fingernails, bamboo shoots driven under their fingernails and have their, and to be impaled and roasted over hot coals? And I mean, what more could a future Antichrist do but that? What could be worse than what Christians have already had to endure? And yet, Christians have always understood that, well, you know, God isn't obligated to deliver us from these things. And if he does not, it has no effect on it being incumbent on us to submit to him and to be loyal to him. Jesus said, "Whoever seeks to save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it unto life everlasting." So they understood that God might not deliver them in a case like this. There had been other godly people that had to suffer martyrdom, and they might be added to that list today. But they knew that he could if he wanted to. But their attitude was, it doesn't matter whether he does or not. Really, in the final analysis, our decision is made. We're not kind of tentative about this. If God will deliver us, then we'll be loyal to him. But if he won't, we'll think about it again. They're firm. In fact, they're defiant. They're almost in his face, you know. Our God is able to deliver us from your hand, O King. If he doesn't, be it known to you, O King, that we will not serve your gods. and we won't worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, these words are calculated to offend a tyrant, and that's exactly what happened. We see that Nebuchadnezzar's expression changed. He was full of fury. He commanded in verse 19 that the furnace be heated up 7 times more than its usual heat. Of course, 7 times is not to be thought of, I think, as a literal figure for a number of reasons. One is they didn't have exact thermometers in those days to know. First of all, I don't know if you can get an ordinary fire 7 times hotter, literally 7 times hotter than its ordinary heat. I mean, certainly with modern technology, I'm sure we can raise the heat of a furnace any way we want to, but a fire that's not specially stoked is mighty hot, and I'm not sure that just by blowing air on it, which is how they stoked it, they could necessarily have increased it by a factor of 7. Nor is it necessary to think so. They wouldn't have known whether they'd reached that factor or not without accurate thermometers anyway. The idea is that they would heat it to maximum heat, 7 being the number of completeness or perfection. And there are many places in Scripture where the number 7 is so used. It simply means a complete number. And to stoke it 7 times hotter than usual simply means to stoke it as hot as you can get it to the maximum heat. We find that they bound Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to avoid them trying to escape. And those men who bound them and threw them into the furnace were killed by the heat. So by trying to kill some loyal and godly administrators, Nebuchadnezzar lost some of his mighty men of valor, because the men who bound them and threw them in were mighty men of valor. They were accomplished military leaders, and they were killed by the heat just by getting close enough to it. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego initially fell down, so they must have been hurled in. I know if I was throwing some guys in there and it was so hot, it was hot enough to kill you, I wouldn't want to get too close if I could help it. And you wouldn't want to escort them in. You know, you'd want to throw them in. And that's what they apparently did, because we're read initially that they fell down bound in the midst of the fiery furnace in verse 23. But next time we hear of them, they're walking around and their bonds are no longer on them. And Nebuchadnezzar gets up to his feet, astonished. He looks in and says, wants to confirm how many people were actually thrown in there. Weren't there 3? And weren't they bound? And it's confirmed to him by those who were witnesses. And he says, but I see 4, and they're not bound. They're loose, walking around. And the 4th of them, it reads in our Bibles, in the New King James and the King James, verse 25, is like the Son of God. There are many who feel that the term the Son of God should not be so rendered. Obviously, in the New King James, Son is capitalized and God is capitalized, so that it kind of conveys to a person with Christian orientation like ourselves that, you know, it conveys the idea of Jesus. It's often been thought, and it may be true, that the person who was in the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was the pre-incarnate Jesus himself, that this was what we call a Christophany or a theophany, where Jesus, even prior to his incarnation, appeared briefly for special purposes. We have reason to believe that that's what happened when Jacob wrestled all night with a certain man. We have reason to believe that that was the case in a number of instances, as when Abraham, in chapter 18 of Genesis, saw 3 men, and one of them is said to be the Lord. There are a number of times in the Old Testament where God or Christ, it's hard to, in the Old Testament, determine which is in view, but either the Father or the Son, probably the Son, since no one has seen the Father, appears in a human form. And this prior to his incarnation. When that happens, that is usually referred to by theologians as a theophany or as a Christophany. The words mean appearance of God or appearance of Christ, respectively. So you can see that the translators of the King James and the New King James, by translating the 4th is like the Son of God, may have been influenced by the Christian theological notion that this was the pre-incarnate Christ in the fiery furnace with them. And I can't claim that it wasn't. I suspect it was. Later on, Nebuchadnezzar indicates that it was an angel, but even that doesn't tell us anything specific, since the word angel, that's in verse 28, by the way, that it says he sent his angel and delivered his servants. The word angel there is capitalized in the New King James also, but again, that reflects the translator's theological leanings. The translators obviously think, and probably most Christians do, and I do too, think that this person that appeared in the fiery furnace was the pre-incarnate Christ. It is possible that it was not the pre-incarnate Christ, so it might have been just an angel, just an ordinary angel sent to deliver them. We're not told otherwise in Scripture, and it nowhere says he was the Son of God. It just says he looked like the Son of God, and most translators today think that the Son of God is not even the correct translation, but rather a Son of the Gods. Now, Christians might object to this alternative translation, a Son of the Gods, in verse 25, but the words in the Aramaic can be translated that way. The word for God is, in Aramaic in this case, very close to the Hebrew word Elohim. And the Hebrew word Elohim in Scripture can be, and should be, at various times translated God, with reference to the true God, and at other times, gods, as in terms of all the pagan gods. Elohim is a plural word. Usually, the decision of whether it's singular or plural in any particular application is made on the basis of the gender of some of the adjectives or verbs or other words in the sentence close to it, so that in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning Elohim created the heavens and the earth, rather than translated gods created the heavens and the earth, it's translated God created the heavens and the earth. Why? Because the word created is a singular verb, although the word Elohim is in itself a plural form. So there are times when the word Elohim and its counterpart in Aramaic can be translated God or gods. In this case, there's perhaps not anything in the sentence that would determine beyond question which he meant. But it seems more likely, first of all, it seems more likely that Nebuchadnezzar, a pagan, would say something like, a son of the gods, since he believed in many gods. To say the Son of God would almost suggest that Nebuchadnezzar had a Christian-like theology, that there was a God and a Son of God. And yet even the Jews at this time didn't know there was a Son of God. The manifestation of Jesus as the Son of God was not until the New Testament. You do not find anything in the Jewish literature. Well, there are some hints in a few prophecies, but the Jews did not, in their worship, acknowledge the triune God. They didn't recognize Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as all parts of Jehovah. That is a Christian theology. It's not found in the Old Testament. So it's not likely, if the Jews didn't know of such, that a Babylonian pagan would. Much more in character for Nebuchadnezzar to say, this guy looks like a son of the gods, which would simply mean he's very godlike. He's very superhuman. And it could have been an ordinary angel. Angels look rather superhuman too at times. Their faces glowing and so forth. And it might have been larger than a human. It might have been bigger and stronger and more impressive generally. And so we don't know too much about this person in the fire. I go along with the basic Christian tradition that this was a theophany. This was Christ appearing to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to encourage them in their loyalty and in their trial. But I'm just warning you not to make too much of the way that it's translated and capitalized in the New King James. That's possible that those are not the best way to translate Nebuchadnezzar's actual words or his intentions. But that doesn't prevent us from as Christians knowing what we do of the New Testament from recognizing that that could be Jesus in there. Well, of course, the remainder of the chapter tells us that Nebuchadnezzar called them out of the furnace and made a decree that anybody who badmouthed their God, as he had sort of done himself, because he kind of defied their God in verse 15, who is that God who will deliver you from my hands? A little bit like Pharaoh saying to Moses, who is Jehovah that I should obey him? It's sort of a defiant word toward God, but Nebuchadnezzar had a change of heart and said, no one in Babylon would be permitted to badmouth the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego without dire repercussions. Yes?
Do you think it was out of amazement, but also fear that he probably said some of those things?
Well, I think people, many people, have been momentarily impressed, you know, when they've had when they've seen something that seems miraculous, or they've had a tremendous answer to prayer, they've been impressed and spoken very pious words about how loyal they will be now from now on to God and how impressed they are with God. But people have short memories. I mean, the fact that Clinton was reelected shows how short people's memories are. You know, everyone has hated him about 6 months before the election, but by the time the election came, everyone had forgotten everything he'd done that was so offensive and elected him again. People are that way with their positive feelings toward people too. And during the Gulf War, George Bush was the hero of the day, but wasn't that just about a year before election time or something? And he was trounced during the election later on. People just forgot how impressed they've been with him. And you see that all the time in people's attitudes toward God. You know, I mean, if they get healed from something or they have some remarkable answer to prayer, they just are momentarily very, you know, sure that they're going to serve God all the days of their life and worship him. But all it takes is a little time and distractions of the world and so forth cause them to forget God altogether. And we've seen that too often to be comfortable. And I think that that's probable with Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know if he ended up a believer. The last we ever read of him is in the end of chapter 4, where he, you know, his last words were those certainly of a believer. But he sounded like a believer in chapter 2 also. But then he made an image. He sounds like a believer at the end of chapter 3. But then he, you know, ignores the dream that God gives him and has to go through a judgment. And so it's hard to know. We just don't have enough information to know how Nebuchadnezzar turned out, how deep his convictions were when he made these positive statements about God. I'd like to think that Nebuchadnezzar got saved. Certainly, every story we have in the Bible about him ends up with something positive, you know, about in with respect to his acknowledgement of God. So maybe the general impression we're left with is that he ends up a believer. But of course, we don't have the last days and hours of his life on record. We don't know how he really ended his life spiritually. Now there are, before we go into chapter 4, there are some general lessons that we might consider from chapter 3 and the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I think that there's a sense in which this story is included and that this miracle is performed in order to illustrate a spiritual thing that has to do with God's faithfulness to Israel, even in the Babylonian exile. One thing we see in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel is that even though the Jews were far from their homeland where the temple was, and even after the temple was destroyed, God was still with his people, with his faithful remnant. Even in faraway Babylon, the land of Nebo and Bel, the false gods, where Jehovah was not honored, where he was honored in the hearts of individuals, he was present. And powerfully so, and manifestly so. There may be even more to the symbolism than that, because when Israel had been in Egypt and was delivered out of Egypt, in the fourth chapter of Deuteronomy, God referred to their Egyptian captivity as the iron furnace. And as God's deliverance from Egypt, in the days of Moses, he referred to as delivering them from the iron furnace. Jeremiah, in anticipation of the Babylonian exile, reflected back on the Exodus and reminded the Jews that they had been delivered from the iron furnace. That you could see, for example, in Jeremiah 11 and verse 4. Jeremiah 11:4, picking up near the end of that verse, God says, "Obey my voice and do according to all that I command you, so you shall be my people and I will be your God." Oops, that's just above that. I should have read just above that. "Which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do according to all that I command you." So he refers to the Egyptian captivity as the Jews being in the iron furnace, the furnace of affliction. Jeremiah gets this language from Deuteronomy 4, verse 20, where Moses first used it. But of course, Jeremiah is anticipating the Babylonian captivity and likening it to it. So that the Babylonian captivity is also like a furnace of affliction, a furnace of refining. God had said in Isaiah and in Jeremiah that the Jews were like unrefined silver and gold, and they needed to go through the refining process to get rid of the dross. And the Babylonian exile was such a refining process. They were put in the furnace. And yet, Isaiah had given this word of